Good evening and welcome to a special edition of Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Steve Brown. This week, we're bringing you stories written and produced by students from last semester's Narrative Radio Journalism class in the College of Communication here at Boston University. The students were given the following assignment: produce a story exploring the topic of immigration. We begin with this report from Ava Aguardo, looking at the changing demographics of East Boston.
Centarpio's Pizzeria has been a part of East Boston for 109 years. It's a modest family restaurant where the sausage is still homemade and the rock and roll music is what the regulars grew up with. While Centarpio's remains pretty much the same, one of the restaurant's waiters says almost everything else in the neighborhood has changed.
Yeah, I feel like a stranger sometimes in my old town.
Michael Gobi grew up in an area called Eagle Hill. That Italian neighborhood of East Boston is now long gone.
It's mainly Spanish, you know. I have one family member, my uncle, still lives there. I don't go there too often. When I do, it seems like mostly Spanish.
In the 1980s, housing prices in East Boston fell, and families from countries like Colombia, El Salvador, and Honduras moved in. According to the latest census, 52% of East Boston is now Latino. And if you don't hear salsa or mariachi music coming from the cars on the street, the local record store, El Poder Musical, has speakers set up outside.
So East Boston's always been the term I use as a gateway community. That's a current term, and because that's what it really is. It's a gateway to America.
That's John Kelly. He's the executive director of the East Boston Social Centers, a nonprofit that provides resources for the community. Even though the gates to East Boston's actual immigration station closed in 1954, newcomers continue to see East Boston as a place to establish their lives.
It's nice to be in the mix and getting to know all these people.
Beatrice Contreras came to Massachusetts 13 years ago from Mexico. When she and her husband were looking to buy a house, East Boston was an affordable option. They also wanted to have kids, so safety was a major factor. They bought a condominium in Orient Heights. And after their daughter was born, Contreras got a job at the East Boston Social Center.
When you're here, you see that the people is really, it's a hard worker people, that there is a lot of good people. And there is a big mix of people.
But that mix makes some longtime residents uncomfortable.
It seemed like there was a lot of kids, a lot of more children playing sports. Not organized sports. More like unorganized sports, just picking up a street hockey game together, going down the baseball field, going down the basketball court. I drive down the summer, I look at the courts, and I don't see anybody on these courts anymore. It's pretty sad.
Nina Estrella Luna is a professor in the School of Public Policy and Urban Affairs at Northeastern University.
It doesn't feel like the same community that I grew up in, which is their code word for saying, yeah, I don't like how it is now. I don't like these people. These people took over my neighborhood. That's their experience.
Estrella Luna lives in East Boston. Though she is a Latina, she has fair skin and jokes that she looks more like she could be Irish than Central American.
I think actually this community is probably going to stay a very diverse Latino community for quite a while. I mean, we've already got the conditions set for that.
Those conditions being that there are Latino-owned businesses that cater to Latinos and other immigrants in the community. East Boston is a community used to being reshaped by outside factors, like it was when Logan Airport was built. Now, developers are looking to add waterfront properties and possibly a $1 billion casino at Suffolk Downs. Both projects would have a major impact on the people of East Boston.
Well, this is a nice, quiet residential neighborhood. We want to keep it a nice, quiet residential neighborhood.
But Estrella Luna says until the community can articulate common goals, it will remain divided.
The class is called Islam 101, and it's taught by Ahmed Rashed. He's 34 years old, was born in Egypt, and raised in the U.S.
Student reporter Josh Mahoney.
The class was initially intended to teach new Muslims about the foundations of the faith, but in 2005, Rashed decided to take it in a different direction, using it to reach out to non-Muslims as well.
The whole purpose of the class is come to our mosque, we're not going to bite, we're not going to bomb, just see who we are, ask all your questions, we want to give you the straight answers, you know, but, you know, come to us. And we'll be more than happy to welcome you.
The Islamic Society of Boston Cultural Center is located at the corner of Malcolm X Boulevard and Elmwood Street in Roxbury. You can recognize it by the distinctly Islamic minaret, which reaches high into the sky and can be seen from a distance.
We're in not a bad part of town, but historically a bad part of town.
Imam Suhaib Webb is the head of the mosque located at the center.
Now it's a lot better, but there are, you know, issues with drugs, issues with psychological abuse, physical abuse. So our location being on the corner kind of puts you on the forefront of the underbelly of Boston.
Webb is an American who converted from Christianity to Islam. Like the Islam 101 class, having an American-born imam is another way the center tries to connect with Boston's non-Muslim population. Webb does not fit the stereotype of an imam. He's easygoing and approachable.
In America, you know, in order to be effective, you need to be somewhat culturally aware of what's going on around you. You need to know how to speak to people. You need to know what to say and how to say it. I think that's rooted more in culture than in religious training.
Webb's congregation consists of a mix of first-generation immigrants and those born here in the U.S. Barak Yilmaz is a Turkish immigrant and congregant of Webb's. He says having an American-born imam helps in a number of ways.
It's definitely an advantage or a blessing to have such a person because, first of all, he's born and raised in the U.S. If you want to talk about Islamic knowledge, he has both the classical knowledge as well as contemporary, because he has knowledge and the culture of this country.
It's this knowledge that allows Webb to connect with one group in particular, young Muslims who struggle to find their identity.
It's a struggle for youth to understand how Islam relates to them when no one's there to inspire them.
Afif Rahman is a student at Northeastern University. He knew of Webb due to his good reputation in the Muslim community. He has since become friends with the imam.
That was the biggest lesson that we learned, I think, from him, knowing that being an American does not need to be suppressed in public. When you're around Muslim people, you don't need to fake being some traditionalist fake being some Arab.
Being a Muslim these days involves trying to find a niche in the post-9/11 landscape. Despite sometimes strained relations between Muslims and non-Muslims, Webb and the center have seen some progress with the local community.
You mentioned that sometimes you'll even get non-Muslims. I mean, how often would you say that happens?
Weekly. It's a sacred space, but it's a sacred open space. So we have a Jewish woman who comes here, I would say, every week, and she just reads. We had a Christian man who came in and said, like, I feel the spirit of Jesus in here. So we're like, no problem. You know, whatever you feel, you feel.
The challenge for Webb is how to use his background to help the Muslim community find a role within Boston, as well as meeting the needs of his congregation.
Student reporter Josh Mahoney. Before that, we heard from Ava Aguardo. This is Boston University's World of Ideas, and tonight we're featuring stories written and produced by students from last semester's Narrative Radio Journalism class in the College of Communication. I'm Steve Brown. Tonight's topic, immigration. Next up, Jessica Kenny reports on one Chelsea resident who's committed to helping refugees.
At the Brown Middle School in Chelsea, Ali Abdulali is meeting with a group of parents, all refugees from Somalia. He is translating English to their language, Somali Bantu. Ali claims that he was created to help refugees.
All my life, I was involved with refugees, even back in Somalia, in Kenya, and here in the United States.
Ali has a tall, lean build. He is always dressed professionally for work, and his comforting manner immediately puts people at ease.
I speak, you could say, 5.5 languages.
Ali arrived in the United States 15 years ago as a refugee himself. He assisted Ethiopian refugees in Somalia and later in Kenya after he was forced to flee Somalia due to civil war.
It was bad. It was horrible. It was very dangerous. Basically, it was either kill or be killed or get out. Those were the three options that were on the table at the time.
Ali and his family members chose the third option and were fortunate to get out safely. Today, Ali is 47, married, and has two children. Just over 5 years ago, he accepted the job as the MGH Refugee School Program Coordinator for Chelsea Schools, and he uses his past experiences to help others.
When I saw this position, it was what I love to do, helping refugees, but this particular job was even better than the ones I did before because it was involved with kids, and I was always working with adults. And I knew that I could change refugee kids' lives for the better.
Ali works with the school's staff, parents, and refugee kids. One of his major roles is to help the school system understand the situations these people are coming from.
We had a student who came from a refugee camp, and she grew up in an environment where she was close to starvation. So when she came here and she saw all this food, it was unbelievable. So she started saving in her locker, you know, either milk or bread or something. And then the milk went bad and it started smelling, and the staff found out. And they thought, you know, this student was playing prank or doing it on purpose.
Stories of starvation, abuse, and violence are part of the history for most of the refugees that Ali works with. He assists 171 children in the Chelsea school system and their parents.
Some of the kids have never been in a classroom before they came to this country.
My name is Houston Akirutiman. I come from Africa.
It's Tuesday morning, and we're at the Intergenerational Literacy Program in Chelsea. Yusta is a refugee from Tanzania. Her family fled Burundi before she was born. She is a mother of four young children and knows that she can always rely on Ali.
I need him a lot. I ask him help us.
Not speaking English was very difficult for Yusta when she first arrived in this country.
It was so hard because I don't speak English or Spanish. Just I know my language when I need to go somewhere. Was so hard to ask.
Yusta relied on Ali for his translation skills.
When I came here upstairs for children's school, he was helping us to translate for us.
But lately, Yusta doesn't see Ali as much because she has English class 4 days a week.
Now I can go store myself, can take bus myself, I can go hair market, I take train myself, I can ask what I want to ask. Not like it before.
Many refugees come from situations in which they never had the opportunity to go to school, and print literacy had no role in their culture. So it's extremely important for refugee parents like Yusta to learn English so they don't become culturally and socially isolated. Back at the Brown Middle School, the Somali Bantu parents tell Ali they're concerned about not being able to read their children's homework or report cards.
English classes for the parents would be very beneficial. That would help immensely.
Ali says that it's difficult to find English classes for the refugee parents in Chelsea. Some people have been waiting for 2 years to get into the program that Yusta attends.
There was a class once and it was full to the brim, but that program did not get funding and it stopped. And they don't have anywhere else that they can turn to.
Ali recently received news that there may be a class beginning. Information is just being released and he is hopeful. If the classes can be sustained, the refugee parents will be given a chance to be self-sufficient and a chance to become a part of the Boston community.
Next up, student reporter Davis Van Opdorp.
We are American. Yep, but you don't have to say we are because it's giving you a...
This is Alawel Majelg, a Sudanese refugee who came to the United States in 1998 with her uncle. Even though she's been in the United States for almost 14 years, she's still in an adjustment period.
This is a different environment, different culture, different people. Back home and here, they're totally different.
Majelk is here being tutored by one of the many volunteers at the Saturday Bridges program at Harding Elementary School as she works to get her GED.
In United States of America, education is fundamentally of getting...
It wasn't initially a tutoring center, at least when the Sudanese Education Fund started it in 2010. Many members of SEF are Lost Boys, the group of Sudanese boys that traveled thousands of miles on foot to escape war between North and South Sudan. Saturday Bridges Program Director Moses Aju has seen this program grow from just a coffee klatch into one that serves over 20 Sudanese families today.
Initially it started that, you know, women would come here and socialize. And then it came to it that, oh, with them coming here, their kids could also get, you know, some educational enrichment program. That's how the original, you know, idea started.
Since the Lost Boys generation arrived in the United States in the 1990s from South Sudan, refugees have migrated out of northern Africa and made their way to the United States. 200 have settled in the Boston area.
We kind of saw that now women are coming after the Lost Boys, and they have gotten into the system a little bit. And then women that are coming, you know, we thought that maybe they are isolated at different, you know, cities, and they don't socialize a lot. And we know that they need time to come together and just chat and be out of their rooms.
Stop. Okay, which one do you want?
You got a sticker?
Alawel Majelk's three daughters of 4, 8, and 9 years old all have different activities at the Saturday Bridges program while their mom gets tutored. 4-year-old Malak plays with other Sudanese children on the floors of the pre-literacy program, collecting stickers and building towers.
Okay, but which one do you want? Look at the sticker. Yeah.
We don't know. Here we go.
You did this already?
8-year-old Madalena builds Lego cars in the gymnasium next door. She has been coming here for 2 years, and even though it takes up her entire Saturday, she has plenty of people who are just like her.
They're not all my friends, they're all my cousins, but I made some friends, but some of them I don't know.
The Sudanese Education Fund has already raised $2.4 million to support the Saturday program, as well as for education grants and technical help for Sudanese immigrants. Alawel could not mention enough how much the program has helped her with her new life in America.
We don't have enough time, especially those who choose to study and go to school. Now we're like in the same page. You're like, hey, I need help too. And that's why Sudanese Education is here for. The kids come with their schoolwork, their weakness, and I'm here, I'm getting help myself. A Saturday program, it's good.
After Majel gets her GED, she plans to go to community college to help her get a job. And the Saturday Bridges program will be with her to help along the way.
When she moved to Boston 7 years ago to join her family, Marie Bernard understood English, but couldn't really speak it.
When I was in Haiti, I know some English at school. I always like to read some book, English French or English Creole too.
Standing about 5'8" and solidly built, Bernard's deep brown eyes and calloused hands reveal a woman whose journey hasn't been easy. When she arrived, she had a 3-year-old son and a daughter on the way. So to speed up the learning process, Bernard began carrying a Creole English dictionary with her everywhere she went, something she still does today.
Everywhere I am, I always read it before I go to the market or hospital. I bring it with me when I left Haiti. That means I keep it safe.
And forget being nervous about approaching strangers.
When I ask something to people, sometimes they're very, very kind to give you an answer. I like that, and that's why I feel more comfortable now. I feel very happy to learn some English until now, though. I'm not scared to talk.
In addition to a full-time job and raising 3 kids, Bernard takes English classes at the Haitian Multi-Service Center in Dorchester. For many new Haitian immigrants, learning English is second in importance only to clearing immigration and finding a place to live. Dr. Guy Apollon is the center's director of health services.
In this country, nobody can function without English. This is one of the main things that everybody needs to learn, to have a job, to function properly. Because a lot of people come with some preparation, and others come with no preparation at all, it's important to tailor the English language acquisition to the needs of the people who come.
The walls of Bernard's living room and her Jamaica Plain home reflect a clash of cultures. A watercolor painting of a beach that is reminiscent of Haiti stands next to decorative signs with English sayings like home is where you make it. The Creole dictionary sits open on the coffee table, its pages tattered and scrawled with notes after years of use. Bernard runs her errands with the dictionary in the morning so her son can use it with homework in the afternoon.
The best thing I do to help my kids with the homework, I use my dictionary to understand some questions they ask him. I don't have to call the teacher to help me, so I just quick help him with my dictionary.
It's the little things about the English language that have been challenging for Bernard over the years. Pronouns, apostrophes, and vocabulary are among the toughest elements for her to master.
If I have to say we, I say you. That was my problem. I understand English, but my answer always have some mistake.
Even though Bernard is still learning, mastering the basics of English is already paying dividends at her restaurant job.
I remember in 2007, I wasn't able to for an interview. After 2 years, I was able to talk to my boss, to talk to everyone at work. I'm better now, much better.
But she's still learning. And Bernard looks forward to the day when she can finally leave that dictionary at home.
That story filed by student reporter Taylor Williams. This is WBUR. I'm Steve Brown. You're listening to a special edition of Boston University's World of Ideas, featuring stories written and produced by students from last semester's narrative radio journalism class in the College of Communication. Tonight's topic is immigration. Next, student reporter Lucia Chen introduces us to one family that represents a true melting pot.
Who's that?
Ada.
Jumali, what's my name?
Ada.
Ada. What is Ada?
A dad.
A dad?
A Danish husband, a Chinese daughter, and an Ethiopian son. Denise Nielsen, a white American girl who grew up in Vermont, chose a different life from most other white American girls.
Because I remember when I was very, very little, and I used to tell people that I was going to adopt a baby from every continent. So I wanted 7 children, and I was going to have a baby from Europe, from South America, from Asia. And it's come full circle a little bit.
Denise and her husband, Carsten, who's from Denmark, tried for 6 years to conceive their own baby. Carsten said it was like a countdown. Every month, they thought there was hope waiting around the corner. But the next moment, they found out everything was still the same.
You're just not willing to deal with it anymore. You get tired of, you know, the cycle of getting your hopes up and getting disappointed and decide it's time to move on.
The Nielsens recorded this video at the orphanage in Jiangxi province in China, where they first met their adopted Chinese daughter, Marley, in 2007.
I remember it was a hot, hot summer day, and we were in a building, like, I don't know, third or fourth floor, and all the babies come in, and all the babies are crying and screaming, and she's the only one who's not crying. She's looking around, she's observant, she's just kind of checking things out, she smiled. She never cried once that day. So we almost knew she was special from the beginning in some ways. We look at her now, she's definitely the one that belongs with us, you know. She's ours.
What's this?
It'd be a
grape. The ice cream cone.
When Marley was 3, Carsten and Denise decided to expand their family. This time, they chose Ethiopia. Unlike China, the Nielsens were allowed to meet their adoptive son Silas's biological grandparents. This is her son from Silas's biological grandmother. She's talking about her dreams about her grandson's future. The Nielsens recorded it when they first met her.
I think originally I was a little bit nervous just because, you know, here they are allowing someone else to take care of their grandchild and to trust somebody else to raise him. And I remember asking the thing that stood out the most, the one thing that when he got older, what they wanted me to tell him about them, what they expected of him, what they wanted him to be. And they said they wanted him to be a man, to grow up to become a man, and to come back to Ethiopia and to help. I thought that was pretty neat.
Denise knows one day her children might want to go back to the countries of their birth.
And I'd like both of them to go back to their country. I mean, right now she talks about China like it's a place that she's, you know, proud of, or she remembers, and sometimes she'll say she remembers being there. But I think it'll sort of come full circle, and I think she'll come back to appreciate, you know, who she is and where she's from.
To Molly, Silas is her best friend and their playmates.
Molly, who's this?
Silas.
Who's Silas?
My brother.
How old is he?
2.
You like him?
Yeah.
They've both been through a lot. He's lost his biological parents. As a child, you don't know how much they remember, but I think somewhere inside them, it does. It makes them stronger. I think it makes them braver. His life experiences have been different. He spent time in an orphanage. He's a tough kid. I mean, he's physically tough, and he's also mentally tough.
That's kind of Gray.
Gray?
Gray, yeah.
But a melting pot with 4 ingredients inside, Danish, American, Chinese, and Ethiopian, Denise said it's not always easy to blend these flavors together.
I mean, in general, we sort of joke about, you know, Danish, the way he grew up in Denmark, it's much more sort of open-minded and liberal as far as, you know, kids are concerned and what teenagers can do and what they're allowed to do. You know, my upbringing was a little bit more sort of strict. I mean, I think both Carson and I think about it every day. How do we raise these kids to be both, to be Chinese and to be American and to be Ethiopian and to be American? It's a mix of everything, and I think we just raise them to be good people, you know, and hopefully they'll take bits and pieces from both cultures, and I guess we'll have to wait and see how they turn out, you know.
Now the family has a new destination, Denmark, where medical care and education will be free for the children. Denise says she can speak Danish, but the language barriers will be a huge issue to the children.
Marley obviously doesn't speak Danish at this age, and Carson's father doesn't speak English. Somehow, it's hard to explain, somehow it doesn't matter. Somehow they communicate, you know, they don't use words, but I don't know how they do it, but they can spend lots of time together and laugh, and sometimes he'll read to her in Danish, and I don't think she's understanding a word he says, but I think it's just somehow they're just being together. They can still feel loved and cared for without actually, you know, the words being understood, I think.
As soon as they find jobs in Denmark, the Nielsens will move out of America. They say they are international citizens, and they want the same thing for their children.
My name is Philip Kisabika. I am the son of immigrants, Ugandan immigrants to be exact. People want to know where my last name comes from, and some of them just don't know where Uganda is. It's in East Africa, if you didn't know. Find Kenya on the map and look to the left.
Americans, they really don't know where Uganda is. They say, is that next to Nigeria?
That's my mom. She's in Atlanta, where I grew up. I'm in grad school in Boston right now, so we talk over Skype.
Sometimes it's rather annoying because they refer to all the Africans as Nigerians. So I'm learning how to handle that and kind of educate each person as I go along.
For me, there's always been three kinds of first-generation Americans. There's the immersive kind, who identify themselves as Americans first and don't care much about their parents' heritage. On the other end, there are those who are surrounded by their parents' culture and dive right into it. I've always been in the middle, knowing where I come from, but keeping it at arm's length. I'd been thinking about all of this when I met a cab driver whose accent sounded familiar.
If not that, we have no time, because much of the time is work.
It turned out that Ronald Mwebe is from a town in Uganda pretty close to where my dad grew up. Ronald's been in the U.S. for more than a decade, and his three sons were born here. My family's part of a large Ugandan community in Atlanta, but I hadn't met many Ugandans in Boston. So Ronald instantly became a link to the country that my parents emigrated from, as well as kind of a reality check of what they've told me about Uganda. I had a lot of questions for Ronald, like what the difference is between raising kids here compared to his experience growing up in Uganda.
There is not that kind of parental relation, because much of the time the parent is at work. When mom or dad comes back, he is already tired, he has the fatigue, he cannot play with the kid. So I find that there is that kind of isolation between mom or between dad and the kid.
My parents saw things similarly. When I was a kid, they worked long hours to provide for my younger brother and me. They immigrated to the U.S. in the early 80s and are now citizens here. Their first vote was in the 2008 presidential election. And when I talked to my mom recently, she had just cast her vote in this year's election.
I voted today.
Oh, you voted?
Yeah.
Who'd you vote for?
It's going to be my little secret.
There's always the question of how immigrant parents pass along their culture to their American-born children. My parents have always made efforts to assimilate my brother and me into Ugandan culture, but not everything sticks. We weren't always the most enthusiastic students.
The first time I took you to Uganda, both of you, maybe you were six, your brother was four, and you just did not have a good time. Everything seemed to you, especially you, everything was filthy. You didn't want to sit anywhere. It was just a culture shock for you.
For me, the most uncomfortable part about that experience, besides the flies and the heat, was a language barrier. My extended family speaks Luganda, the most widely spoken language in Uganda.
It was tough for you because you didn't know what they were talking about, and it was tough for them because they could not speak English.
As much as the news about Uganda over the years has been negative, with civil wars and unrest dominating the headlines, people from there believe it's a great place to grow up, even though the opportunities are greater here.
Back home, you can leave him home without feeling that anybody can come and steal my kid or snatch my kid from either the compound or whatever. Not the same as here. Here, you don't know your neighbor, and your neighbor doesn't know you.
When I asked my mom about that aspect of life here, she agreed that family in Uganda is a lot more than people inside the home.
It's a true saying whereby it says it takes a village. The whole of my street is in charge of my kids. They can discipline them, they can tell them what to do, and they are really part of a household.
The older I get, the more I realize how tough it was for my parents to balance being in this country and getting my brother and me to understand the culture of their home so we could feel close to it. We have family in the U.S., but the majority of them are overseas. My mom said she only had a couple of regrets in our upbringing.
Right from the beginning, when you guys were younger, I really longed that my parents, I wish they were nearer to me, because in terms of teaching you the language, nobody would have done it better than grandma and grandpa. The other thing is that you cannot speak the language fluently, which I would have wanted you to do. Because once you learn the language, nobody can take it away from you.
It all gets me thinking. When I have kids eventually, what will I tell them about our last name? What could I tell them if I don't know everything I should know? My parents have done their best, but the rest is on me.
I think you've turned out okay, and hopefully you pass it down to your children.
It seems like I'll always be between two worlds, but it can't hurt to even things out a bit. I'm Philip Kisubika.
Keep it up, son.
In the Prospect Hill, Moody Street section of Waltham stands a church reminiscent of Anglo-Saxon architecture. St. Peter's Anglican Church of Uganda serves as a nucleus for a Ugandan immigrant community, a section of the city earning the name Little Kampala. Waltham is home to an estimated 1,500 Ugandans who primarily work in the healthcare field. The priest in charge of the Ugandan congregation, Reverend Christine Nachiuni, dresses in what seems to be layperson attire, but also dons a traditional priest collar.
As members, you know, parishioners, they will contribute to both the church and the community. We have individuals who will say, oh, I come from this particular area, so I'm going to support my church. I will give a tithe or something like that.
Certainly she knows as well that the church she leads is important in keeping her community cohesive.
As a church, we help that girl you see over there. we pay tuition for her.
The girl Nachiuni is referring to is on a poster on the wall. She's a young schoolgirl who is going to school thanks to the generosity of donations from the Ugandan parish in Waltham. And then there are the other children that Nachiuni shares high hopes for, the Ugandan immigrants who live here in Waltham and attend her church.
That's a hot topic in our congregation because, you know, we're trying to find ways that we have the youth who were born here or who came here young, because, you know, when you come here, when you're very young, you're formed by the American community, and so you tend to belong more this way than there. And so you find that sometimes there's a disconnect between our congregation because you would say we are traditional, you know, a way of worship.
Nachiuni worries that preservation of Ugandan culture is diminishing and insists that preservation of culture is key in determining the youth's future involvement in her congregation. Just down the street from St. Peter's is the Global Evangelical Church based on Moody Street. William Katarega, a parishioner of Global Evangelical, is also a Ugandan native living in Waltham. He is self-employed and owner of a cleaning service for corporate real estate properties. And he meets with me at a busy cafe in Boston's North Station during his lunch break.
I think I would say mostly why Uganda is so much populated in Waltham. It's an accessible city.
Katurega, like many Ugandans, lives frugally here in America, and through his church also generously gives back to his home country.
Many of them have gone to college, especially those we help, you know, because we want to make sure that they go higher and higher. They are in Africa, in Uganda. We have Makerere University, we have Chambogo, we have Mukono Christian University.
Katurega founded a secondary school in Uganda, appropriately named after the city that helped it reach this goal, which is to educate orphans devastated by the AIDS epidemic. The World Health Organization estimates that more than 1 million Ugandans have died from the disease.
In Uganda, we have many orphans. These orphans whose parents died of AIDS.
And although there has been much improvement in recent years, roughly 1 million Ugandan children have been orphaned.
So then I had a vision of starting a school, a secondary school, whereby I can help students who didn't have a chance to go for higher education.
The school is approximately 17 miles east of Kampala, and the current enrollment is 380 students.
I bought land, I started the building, because I felt that myself coming to this great nation, USA, it was a blessing.
Within the past year, Katurega has gone back and visited Uganda. While there, he oversaw construction progress on the school. His wish is that the school he founded continues to grow in scope.
The Wotham School, actually, I think we are planning in the future to have a fundraising to make it open to other people who are generous, who can become partners, you know.
Katurega hopes the next step for the school is partnerships with other schools. He likes the idea of a sister school for the facility he's founded. The best match for Waltham College, he feels, would be to partner with a school nearly 7,000 miles away in Waltham, Massachusetts.
Student reporter Joe Lyman. This is WBUR. I'm Steve Brown. You're listening to a special edition of Boston University's World of Ideas, featuring stories written and produced by students from last semester's narrative radio journalism class in the College of Communication. Tonight's topic is immigration. In our final segment tonight, we hear reports from students Matt DeFonso and Adam Ellsworth.
Brianna Mai is a quick study. Show her the moves to a traditional Cambodian dance, and in no time at all, she has it down.
It's like, I know the puzzle pieces, I know how to put them together.
It took Brianna years to learn the puzzle pieces that make up Cambodian dance, but an instant to fall in love with the dancers themselves.
I went to a show with my mom, and I thought it was, like, amazing and beautiful. Like, you know, just all these bright colors and the sparkles on their outfits, and I was like, Mommy, I want to try that.
Brianna was 4 at the time. She didn't know it, but that's exactly what her mother was hoping she'd say. The house Brianna grew up in was once surrounded by muddy ground. Now, thanks to all the expansion at UMass Lowell, the house is virtually on the college campus. And that's where Brianna goes to school. She wanted the full college experience, so she lives in a dorm just a mile or so from the house. Her mother, Bonna, still lives there, and Brianna visits often. Not that these visits are enough for Bonna.
It's not easy, but gradually I've learned to accept it. I'm not fully accepting it yet, so.
Growing up in Cambodia, Bonna always loved the traditional dances of her homeland.
I wanted to do it back when I was in Cambodia, but my parents wouldn't let me because they don't believe girls should be in entertaining business.
If Bonna's parents hadn't kept her from dancing, the dictator Pol Pot and his revolution would have. Pol Pot believed in an agrarian utopia. He was against city living and everything that came with it. Newspapers, books, TVs, even dancing. Of course, Pol Pot's agrarian ideal was only possible with forced labor. Families like Bonna's, who lived in the city, were sent to work camps in the countryside. Bonna and her family fled to a refugee camp in Thailand. After about a year and a half there, they came to the U.S. Bonna never forgot her dream of dancing. She just knew that someone else would have to live that dream for her.
So when I had my own child, I said, one of these days, I'm going to make them dance.
Not that Bonna felt she could make any of her children do anything. Certainly not Brianna. But Bonna figured if she could just show Brianna the dancing, take her to a performance, maybe it would stick. She was right.
Good evening. Welcome to the 25th
anniversary of the Encore Dance Troupe, world premiere of the Opera Dancing Stones.
Brianna's been dancing in public for years. The biggest performance for her and the Encore Dance Troupe came just a few months ago. Hundreds of people gathered to celebrate the troupe's 25th anniversary and the premiere of the new dance drama, Opera Dancing Stones. Opera Dancing Stones mixes contemporary dance styles with traditional dances to tell the story of Cambodia. The two scenes Brianna dances in are completely traditional. Every movement is deliberate, from the slight bend in the small of the back to the point of the fingers. They seem to happen in slow motion. Each movement has a meaning and is infused with history. Brianna says she doesn't think about that while she's dancing. Tonight is no different. Her mind is on more immediate matters.
Bree, don't lose your balance, don't lose your balance. Bree, there's no audience. Pretend everyone's in their underwear. Don't worry about it.
In one scene, a mythical creature destroys a temple in Cambodia, symbolizing the desecration that occurred during Pol Pot's reign. For Brianna's mother, who lived through this era, it's an emotional moment.
I broke down.
Brianna knows the history of Cambodia. She knows what her mother had to go through, and she knows the meanings behind the dances she and the troupe perform. But Brianna's life growing up as an American has been far different from her mother's life under the Pol Pot regime. Cambodian dance helps Brianna stay connected to her heritage and to her mother, and Brianna expects to continue dancing for a long time.
Until I can't move anymore, until I'm incapable, or until I start, obviously, looking older than everybody else, significantly older. Yeah.
Maybe by then, she'll have a child of her own who can pick up wherever she leaves off.
Jose Fernando Solis Camara Martinez is a relative newcomer to water polo. He started out in Mexico, playing a different water sport.
Actually, when I was very little, one of my dad's friends, his son drowned when he was a kid. So my dad was like in shock. And he's like, my son is going to like learn how to swim since he's very young. So I started swimming.
And Jose became a pretty good swimmer too.
All the little competitions when I was four, I used to beat everyone by like a lap.
Jose twice swam in a 7-mile race that goes from Cancun to a nearby island. And he even set a world record the first time he competed.
Yeah, but it wasn't like fastest time. It was like, I think youngest kid. It was when I was 10.
Jose definitely enjoyed swimming when he lived in Mexico.
In Mexico, I had my group of friends from my swimming team, and like we used to go to competitions, and like we had a lot of fun. Like it was fun being on the team.
But in October 2004, Jose and his family moved to Miami so they could get better help for his autistic younger brother. And in America, swimming wasn't fun anymore.
Instead of like enjoying it like in Mexico, I was swimming basically by myself for like 2.5 hours every day, and I didn't like it at all.
Jose moved from school to school in his early years in America, and he stopped swimming on a team. He tried other sports, football, tennis, cross country, and track, but soccer was the sport that fit Jose best, even more than swimming.
As a swimmer, you're like by yourself. It's kind of like meditating, you could say, because it's only like you there and back, like a bunch of turns. So you're thinking by yourself for as long as you're swimming.
But Jose does have some regrets about leaving the swim team.
When I moved to Miami and I had to swim a lot, like 3 hours a day or 2.5 hours, and Saturdays 5 hours, I got really tired of it because first I didn't have any friends and swimming was getting really intense. So I kind of left it, and now I think I'm back and I wish I would have kept on, you know?
Even after he stopped swimming on a team, water sports remained a part of his life in the form of swimming with his father and wakeboarding. And when he arrived at BU, swimming with a ball pulled Jose in. He joined the water polo team as a freshman.
Hey guys, let's go, set up!
I went to the first practice and I loved it because I got really tired and the people in the water polo team were very nice and it was a new sport for me, so like everything was new and I was overwhelmed. Like a good overwhelm.
Even though being on the water polo team is sometimes uncomfortable for Jose, he's still having a good time.
In the tournament, I made friends with the freshmen. I made friends with everyone, even the coach. So you really make me feel more comfortable. It's a lot of fun to hang out with the guys.
Jose says he makes more friends at every water polo practice, so he must be friends with all his teammates by now.
Go, Captain!
This summer I went swimming, this summer I might have drowned, but I held my breath and I kicked my feet and I moved my arms around.
Student reporter Matt DeFonza. That concludes tonight's special edition of Boston University's World of Ideas, featuring stories written and produced by students from last semester's Advanced Radio Journalism class in the College of Communication. Our student contributors were, in order of appearance, Ava Aguardo, Josh Mahoney, Jessica Kenny, Davis Van Opdorp, Taylor Williams, Lucia Chen, Philip Kisubika, Joe Lyman, Adam Ellsworth, and Matt DeFonso. Thanks to Ann Donahue and John Rudolph, who helped edit their stories. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mark Degon, with help from Mike Toda, Michael Garth, and Paul Vikas. The executive producer for Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydotis. I'm Steve Brown. Thanks for joining us.